Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Market. I'm your guest host, Drew Yelm, sitting in for Radio Free Market founder Michael McKay. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Today's topic, globalization of trade. Is it a blessing or a curse? We are talking with Dr. Donald Boudreau. Welcome to the show, Dr. Boudreau.
Good to be here.
Dr. Boudreau is professor of economics at George Mason University. He's also the director of the Center for Study of Public Choice there at George Mason. He is the author of Globalization, and he blogs at Cafe Hayek, cafehayek.com. So to start off the show, I just wanted to really introduce our listeners with the idea of trade. So what exactly is trade?
Free international trade is just the process of treating exchanges that take place across political borders no differently than you treat exchanges that take place within political borders. Now, I personally believe that even trades that take place within political borders should be a lot more free than they are in America and elsewhere. But given however free they are or not free in America, there should be no extra burdens attached to Americans who wish to purchase things from abroad or who wish to sell things from abroad. And when you have the absence of those additional burdens, taxes or regulations or restrictions, then trade is free. That's what economists mean by free trade.
So why exactly then would somebody want to trade with another person, whether it's somebody in their neighborhood or somebody in Russia?
Well, you know, the reasons for a consumer wanting to buy any particular good, of course, are many. Prices is an important one, the quality of the good, the perceived quality of the good. But whatever the reasons, it's none of the government's business why a consumer wishes to engage in a peaceful capitalist act. And so if someone in my home state of Virginia wishes to buy, a bottle of wine from a Virginia vintner, we actually have a few pretty good wineries here in Virginia, that's that person's business. If that person instead wants to buy wine from California, that's that person's business. If that person wants to buy wine from France or from South Africa, that too is that person's business. And none of those transactions should be treated differently from any of the others. We don't have to inquire into the reason why any person might want to buy something from a foreign producer as compared to buying it from a domestic producer. If the consumer, by the process of spending his or her own money, reveals that he or she prefers to buy the foreign good, that's all I need to know. That tells me all I need to know, that in that consumer's eyes, that good being bought from abroad is the best thing that consumer can do with whatever sums of money the consumer spends on that thing. It's none of my business to stop that consumer. It's none of government's business to stop that consumer.
When economists talk about comparative advantage, what exactly do they mean?
Well, the comparative advantage is an economic principle that traces back to what's commonly regarded as tracing back to an economist named David Ricardo, who first mentioned it in his book, his 1817 book, The Principles of Political Economy and Taxation. Ricardo's book was really the second great economic treatise in the English language after Adam Smith's book, The Wealth of Nations, that was published in 1776. And Ricardo took Smith, I wouldn't say one step further, he offered a different reason to the one offered by Smith for why free trade by free trade benefits all parties involved. Comparative advantage says that look, even if people in one country can produce every good that people in that country want to consume, produces more cheaply in terms of how much labor is used in that good, then it still pays for that country to trade freely with producers and consumers in other countries. Comparative advantage is certainly right up there with one of the most difficult analytic concepts that economists have. It's very difficult to explain verbally. It can be explained very easily.
We'll have to catch up on the other end of the break, Dr. Boudreau. We're coming up break on the Radio Free Market. Please stay tuned. Welcome back to Radio Free Market. I'm your guest host, Drew Yelm. On the phone with me is Dr. Donald Boudreau, and we're talking about free trade. Now, before the break, you were saying that comparative advantage is actually kind of a hard concept to explain. Can you kind of, I guess, go into that a little bit further?
Here's a good example of comparative advantage, and it's an example that's real. I was for 8 years department chairman of the economics department at George Mason, and we have a wonderful secretary in that department, and she's retired now. Her name is Kathy, and Kathy she's a little short woman, very, very talented, a really short woman, and she was older than me, but whenever I would need documents delivered by hand from my office to the dean's office or to the president's office, I would always give them to Kathy to deliver. Now, I can walk faster than Kathy. I'm younger, I have longer legs, and I'm in better health than she was. But I would still give those documents to Kathy to deliver. And the reason is not because Kathy could walk faster than me. She couldn't. She walked more slowly. The reason is because my time while at work was actually more valuable than Kathy's. I was a better producer of departmental policies than Kathy. And so rather than have my time consumed by walking across campus, delivering papers, and then walking back, even though I could do it faster than Kathy, it was better for me to give it to Kathy and have her walk it across campus and walk back. In other words, her spending her time walking those papers to and from different offices was a more efficient use of the total time in our office. I had a comparative advantage in staying in the office and doing my job. Kathy had a comparative advantage in delivering documents by hand, even though, in some sense, I was a better document deliverer. I could go faster than her.
This is kind of the reason why people then would hire somebody else to work for them. So say, for example, I have a factory. It's more beneficial for me to hire people to work in the factory than it is for me to operate every machine in the factory.
Yeah. Yeah, an example that was given a while back was that when Michael Jordan was playing basketball, let's say Michael Jordan was the world's fastest typist. You know, he really excelled in typing in high school, right? Well, even though Michael Jordan may be the world's fastest typist, it would be absurd to employ Michael Jordan in a secretary pool or doing word processing, because his talent at basketball were even that much better. And so what the principle of comparative advantage says is we want to use not only workers, but all resources, land, machines. We want to use resources in the things that they do the very best, and then and produce those things and then trade for all the rest. Specialize in what you do best and trade for the rest. And what David Ricardo did when he first explained the principle of comparative advantage almost 200 years ago, he was just extending the larger principle that Adam Smith first identified in 1776, and that is, if people voluntarily choose to trade, both parties are made better off. And there's nothing about trade across a political boundary or border that makes that trade any different than a trade that takes place within the border. And so because we sort of automatically, naturally, usually recognize that if I want to, buy groceries from the store across the street to the north as opposed to the store across the street to the south, I should be free to patronize whichever store I think gives me the best deal. The same thing, the same principle applies to international transactions. There's no economic significance to political borders. That's the ultimate conclusion that you take away from studying what economists have to say about free trade. And I want to add real quickly, economists, we get criticized, sometimes justly, for disagreeing with each other on issues involving macroeconomics and the stimulus and what should be the money, the proper monetary policy. Those criticisms are justified. We have no consensus on those matters. But when it comes to trade, there is a huge consensus in economics, and always has been. And that consensus extends from economists on the left all the way to economists on the right to libertarian economists, almost all economists, 90%, literally, that's something like the number, agree that tariffs and import restrictions are harmful, and conversely, that free trade is beneficial.
Yeah, I'd kind of like to look into this idea of, you know, protectionism. So what exactly are the just, like, when people say that, oh, right, well, we need to, say, for example, protect the steel industry from competition from overseas, does everybody benefit from such a policy?
No. In fact, most people lose from such a policy. Workers in the steel industry benefit. More generally, suppliers of the steel industry benefit. Shareholders and maybe bondholders of the steel industry benefit, but consumers in general don't benefit. And if you protect any producer from competition, that producer and its workers benefit. If you protect, people talk about the automobile industry, of course. The automobile industry, along with steel, is probably the most notorious industry that through the years has sought protection from foreign competitors. And some people think, well, if we protect General Motors and Chrysler and Ford from foreign competition, won't that benefit America? Because General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler are part of America, so by protecting them from foreign competition, we help America. That's looking at what the French economist Frédéric Bastiat said, what is seen. We have to look also at what is not seen. When we restrict Americans' abilities to buy foreign cars, to the extent that we restrict it, there are a number of factors that most people don't think about, that economists do think about. Number one, the competitive pressures on the domestic auto producers are lowered. And I don't care who you are, if you know that your market is protected, you're not going to work as hard as you otherwise would to please consumers. You're not going to make yourself as efficient as you would. You're not going to keep reducing your costs. You're not going to keep your prices as low. You're not going to produce a product with as high a quality as you would. You also restrict, by imposing tariffs and other import restrictions, you restrict free consumer choice. By restricting free consumer choice, clearly, by taking away options from consumers that they otherwise would have gone for, that they would have opted to use, you make consumers worse off to that extent.
Jump in here. So earlier when you talked about competitive advantage, you said that basically you're trying to, with competitive advantage and trade, you're trying to figure out the best and most optimal way of using resources.
Right.
What it kind of sounds like when you're talking about protectionism is it's taking away that efficient market discovery mechanism.
Absolutely. Probably the biggest thing that is not seen, in addition to the two that I just mentioned, is, look, when Americans buy products from abroad, they pay dollars for those products. The only reason foreigners are willing to accept dollars for American goods and services is because foreigners want to return those dollars to America as demand for either American goods and services or to invest those dollars in America. Both of those things help Americans. And so, for example, quite honestly, the Japanese buy a lot of lumber from the United States, as it happens. And so if we stopped Americans from buying Japanese-made cars, then the Japanese would have fewer dollars, so the Japanese would buy less lumber from us. So we could protect some jobs in the U.S. auto industry, but we would eliminate some jobs in the U.S. lumber industry. But those jobs are more difficult to see. And what's also more difficult to see is, as you just alluded to, Drew, is that what we're doing is protecting jobs in an industry in which we're relatively inefficient, automaking, and taking away jobs in industries in which we're relatively efficient, lumbering. So a nation doesn't move to prosperity by protecting its less efficient producers from the competition of foreigners, because by doing so, it also, in addition to protecting the less efficient producers, it harms and reduces the size of the market of that country's more efficient producers.
Okay, but
and then when foreign,
well, I was going to say one of the excuses that the advocates for, you know, kind of protecting trade is that, well, but you've got foreigners that also subsidize their industry, or they create tariffs. So if they create tariffs, then it's necessarily something that America should do in order to protect our industry over here.
Yeah, the great myth. I'm glad you brought that up, because this is in fact, it appeared just yesterday in a letter to the editor in the Wall Street Journal. It is one of the biggest myths. A country that subsidizes its industries or subsidizes its exports does not help a government that subsidizes government does not help that country. It hurts that country. It's true. It helps the firms in that industry in that country. But if let's say China, I don't know if China really does this. It's very difficult to actually tell what the Chinese do. But if China is subsidizing consumer electronics producers, that helps America and hurts the Chinese, because it's using government money, paying government money from taxpayers Chinese taxpayers who would spend it as they wish, funneling it into an industry that shouldn't get that much according to market signals. I guess that's why the government has to give it that money, because it's not getting it according to the market. And so the first thing you notice is when the Chinese subsidize their export industries, it makes China as a whole poorer. It makes America richer. It's the Chinese government forcing the poor Chinese people to subsidize rich Americans' consumption of consumer electronic goods. Point of competition is one of the points of competition is this. You never evaluate an economic outcome by looking to see how well it treats producers. You always evaluate an economic outcome or an economic policy by looking to see how well it helps consumers. The point of economic activity is not to produce, it's ultimately to consume. And so when the Chinese subsidize their industry, they hurt themselves. And for us to say, oh, well, we should subsidize our own industries in retaliation would be like saying, well, you know, my neighbor's over there shooting himself in the toes, so I think I'm going to start shooting myself in the toes to show him.
That's an excellent point. We're going to have to go to a break here on Radio Free Market, but that was an excellent point to leave us. Please stay tuned for more Radio Free Market after the break. Welcome back to Radio Free Market. I'm your guest host, Drew Yelm. I'm talking with Dr. Donald Boudreau about globalization and free trade. And before the break, we were talking about protectionism. And one of the interesting things about protectionism that I've seen is the raw politics of it. I guess, as the public choice economists always put it, you have a lot of distributed costs for a very slim benefit. Could you kind of, you know, put that into context with protectionism?
Oh yeah, it's a very good point to make. And tariffs and other forms of protectionism are classic examples of what the public choice economists call the special interest group effect. The benefits of protectionist policies are concentrated on a relatively small number of people. The owners and the workers in the industries that are protected. But the people who pay the cost, and the costs are always larger than the benefits in total. The people who pay the cost, though, are pretty much the society at large. And so if you have, say, only 100,000 people working in the industry that's protected, but you have 300 million Americans who have to pay higher prices as a consequence of the protectionism, each of those 100,000 people, because those benefits are concentrated on them, they feel them, and they appreciate those benefits. But the costs are spread out over 300 million people, and so when you spread out even larger costs over such a larger number of people, no one person really feels those costs. And so, and even if they do feel them, the costs for any one person usually not large enough to prompt individuals to take action to oppose the protectionism. Tariffs always benefit concentrated interest groups. One of the most amusing things to me and to other economists is to hear uninformed people say things like this. Well, free trade is in the benefit of corporate interests. And that's just nonsense. You show me a piece of protectionist legislation or a tariff, and I will show you a corporation that benefits from it and that lobbied for it. It's true, from time to time, some corporations, some corporations will lobby for free trade. Sometimes it's in their incentives, particularly if they want to get supplies at lower costs from abroad. But every piece of protectionist legislation is done at the behest of well-paid, organized producers.
How does the saying go? The people that hate capitalism most are the capitalists.
Yeah. It's just a myth to think that free trade is a pro-capitalist policy any more than protectionism. protectionism is the policy that capitalists like.
Well,
each piece of protectionism is the spawn of the lobbying of one capitalist group or another. Free trade, in contrast, is the policy for unorganized, largely politically voiceless consumers. Free trade is the policy of the masses. Protectionism is the policy of the protected capitalist classes.
Well, like, I don't know, all these presidential candidates get on television, they talk about, well, they're for free trade, but they want fair trade. Is fair trade really all that fair? Like, when I go to the coffee shop, it costs, like, I don't know, a dollar extra to buy a coffee because it's, you know, sugar-grown coffee or something. What exactly is fair trade? Is fair trade a good deal for the consumer?
No, although there are two different meanings of fair trade, and I'm not fond of either one, but the older meaning of fair trade, which dates back at least 50 years, has nothing to do with how well workers are treated in foreign factories. It's just a weasel term that protectionists use to be able to stay there for free trade, but to allow them to actually espouse non-free trade practices. So, for example, if a foreign country is or is alleged to be subsidizing its export industry, or if a foreign country is alleged to have some other type of unfair advantage, protectionist at home will say, oh, well, I'm in favor of free trade, but we can't trade with that country because that would be unfair. And count on it. Whenever anyone uses the word unfair to talk about economic policy, right, they don't know what they're talking about. The term is used almost always, 99.99% of the time, as a weasel word. It's meant to deflect attention from the hard facts and hard reasoning that should go into analyzing policy. You're either for free trade or you're not. Another way it says, free trade is fair trade. It's fair to let people spend their money as they choose or not choose, and vice versa. The second meaning of fair trade, the much more recent meaning, is this notion that because foreign workers, particularly agricultural workers, are paid less than workers in the first world country, products get labeled, quote, fair trade, unquote, products if somehow their producers can convince some labeling authority, some certification authority, that these firms operate in ways that don't unduly abuse workers. I'm not so much opposed to that. I think it's largely a sham. But if people voluntarily want to spend more money to buy fair trade coffee as opposed to non-fair trade coffee, that's their business. What I oppose is the government getting involved in these things. I should say, I never go out of my way to buy fair trade labeled stuff. I look at the price, I look at the quality. Because the fairest trade is to spend your money as you see fit and to let the forces of competition lift foreigners, even those foreigners today who are in third world countries, out of poverty in the same way that competition and freedom lifted Americans out of poverty 200 and 100 years ago.
We're going to have to take another break here on Radio Free Market. Please stay tuned after the break. We're going to talk about jobs. Welcome back to Radio Free Market. I'm your guest host, Drew Yelm. I'm talking with Dr. Donald Boudreau about globalization and free trade. And before the break, we were talking a little bit about jobs and fair trade. And I guess, you know, to throw it out there, so when firms start importing, when Americans start importing goods, doesn't that mean that jobs are stolen by somebody from somewhere else?
No, as I said earlier in the program, when we import more of one type of good, we export more of other types of goods. Again, foreigners sell things to us only because they want to buy things from us. And so we exchange jobs. We exchange those jobs that are relatively less efficient, and we get in return jobs that, well, we get in return are goods and services from abroad, but what's created on the jobs front here at home are jobs that are more productive than the ones that were destroyed by the trade. It is true, of course, that overwhelmingly the objection to free trade is that it allegedly reduces domestic employment. There is no evidence for that claim, no solid evidence. You can find, of course, if you Google it, you can find fake economists who will say there's evidence, and they'll even bandy about numbers, but no serious economist, again, regardless of where they are in the political spectrum, no serious economist believes that trade over time reduces the level of domestic employment. The level of, nor does it increase the level of domestic employment. The level of domestic employment over time is invariant to trade. What trade does is make jobs, what free trade does is make jobs more efficient, more productive. What protectionism does is make jobs less efficient, less productive, and hence lower paying. And another thing to keep in mind is, you know, again, people, they single out foreign trade as if it somehow is uniquely responsible for causing economic change. It is true that when Americans start buying more cars made abroad, well, that means they buy fewer cars made domestically. But foreign trade is a small portion of our economy. Technological change eliminates jobs. Changes in consumer tastes and preferences eliminates jobs. I have two favorite examples on this front. About 10 years ago, it's faded a little bit, but about 10 years ago, you and your listeners might remember, there was this big fad for the Atkins diet, where people would, you know, eat a low-carb diet and high-protein diet and lose weight. Well, that's a change in consumer taste and preferences. What the Atkins diet did was cause a lot of donut shops to go bankrupt. And it had nothing to do with foreign trade. It was just a change in consumer taste and preferences. But we don't say, oh, the economy should stop consumers from changing the way they spend their money, just consumers from adopting a new diet because it might cause people to lose jobs. We accept economic change, and we should accept the job losses and job creation that come with it, because that is in the essence of, it's at the core of a productive economy. Another example I'd like to give is nearly 60 years ago, Jonas Salk and Dr. Sabin each invented the polio, you know, different variant of the polio vaccine. And one of the great things in the past 60 years, and I'm one of them, I'm sure you are too, is that we finally live in a generation where no one in the modern world has to worry about polio. Polio was a terrible disease that killed some people, it crippled many of them. So what did the polio vaccine do to jobs? Well, it put out a job, it put people who worked in wheelchair factories out of their jobs. It put people who made iron lung machines out of jobs. It reduced the demand for people who made crutches, because polio victims had to use crutches. It reduced the demand for doctors and nurses and hospitals to specialize in caring for polio.
Was there a big public outcry for the loss of manufacturing jobs in iron lungs?
Oh, no, I'm not. Well, I was born in 1958, and the polio vaccine, I think, was first in 1954. I don't recall, but I'm sure there wasn't. I mean, you can't imagine, because, we have to stop this polio vaccine because it's reducing the factory employment, people making iron lung machines. But there was no outcry against the Atkins diet in 2000, because it was reducing the demand for people who worked in breweries and in donut shops. The world we live in is constantly churning with changes in consumer taste and the way this consumers spend their money. It's constantly changing with new technologies. Advances in technology every year put far more people out of work in America than changes in trade patterns do. The invention of the microprocessor largely eliminated the secretarial pool eventually. My mom used to work as a secretary for a while, a secretarial pool. She wouldn't have such a job today. She would have some other kind of job.
Well, another one of the common complaints that I've heard, though, is, you know, with these increases in trade, that prices get so low that, you know, now everybody works at Walmart and nobody has even any money to buy these goods coming from overseas anymore. Is there a decrease in livelihood as a result of increases in trade?
No, but you'll hear people on the left, and they've insisted now for about 15 years that the standard of living of ordinary Americans has not increased since 1973, and that's just nonsense. It's just frankly BS. It is true. If you look at the inflation adjusted, according to the Consumer Product Index, inflation adjusted wage paid to the median worker, it hasn't changed much since 1973. But what has increased since 1973 is, number one, the amount that workers get paid in fringe benefits. So we get a lot better health care. That's paid for in fringe benefits since then. But one reason the median wage is not rising is because we've had a lot more women enter the labor force since 1973. We've had a lot of immigration, and those factors pull down the average and the median wage. But that doesn't mean that ordinary Americans aren't living as well. And also, the inflation adjustment is all. I think it's by and large it's very weak, because one of the incredible things that's happened, especially over the last 40 years, is not so much an increase in the quantity of goods and services that are new for the American consumers to buy. That's certainly true; it has increased, but the quality has improved so dramatically, and it's very difficult to adjust for quality in the inflation data. And so, if you look at alternative ways that I think are better than the Consumer Price Index to adjust for quality and what ordinary Americans can buy with their wages, what you see is that since 1973, the standard of living for Americans has continued to rise, really no less than it had done in previous decades. And so, yes, we're trading more now than we were in the 60s and earlier, but in fact we're not poorer. Anybody who's lived as long as I've lived, I'm 53 years old, there's no comparison. We are so much, ordinary Americans are so much wealthier today than they were back in the 70s. It's not funny, but it is glorious.
Well, you talked exactly about, you know, prices and quality. I mean, Mike, you know, you can buy a computer now on really awesome little netbook for like $300, whereas my dad talked about when he bought his first computer in the early 80s, it cost closer to $5,000-$6,000.
I bought my first computer, and my parents were poor. I stayed up a long time for this. I bought my first computer to write my PhD dissertation. I bought it in January of 1985. It was an IBM 256 double floppy disk computer, monochrome screen, of course, no internet connection. We didn't know what an internet was. A web back then was something that spiders wove. That computer cost me, I remember, $2,400 in 1985 dollars. If you translate that now into 2011 dollars, it's close to $6,000. And all it could do was basic word processing and spreadsheets. You know, now the thing, people wouldn't pay 10 cents for it. But I have more computing power on this thing I'm holding in my hand talking to you right now than that computer had. And I paid $199 for it. And it can take pictures, pretty nice pictures too, by the way. So the level of progress over the past 30 and 40 years has been astonishing. Unfortunately, the quality of the statisticians in the Commerce Department and other places that try to measure changes in economic welfare have not kept up with it. And so it does give the wrong impression about the level of our economic progress. And that mistaken impression is, of course, pounced on by people on the left and other people with an agenda to claim that the American economy has been stagnant. It has not.
Well, no. I mean, so we talked about Americans, and we've talked a lot about Americans since we've been talking, but what about when jobs are shipped overseas to these foreign countries? One of the most common complaints against globalization is that all these countries, they employ slave labor and sweatshops, and they don't pay their workers anything, and everybody's made poorer when these companies go over there. Is that true at all?
No. Americans have gotten richer as we've traded more, but also so too have the people with whom we're trading. I saw a statistic just yesterday, the day before, and I don't remember exactly. It was something like 30 million Chinese have been lifted out of poverty just in the last decade by the market liberalization and trade policies in China. And the number is not quite as large, but still huge for India. And so when people trade, they're able to specialize in what they do best, and people pay them for that. It's true. People in China and India and Malaysia are not yet as wealthy as Americans. But we were not as wealthy. Our ancestors in the 19th century were not as wealthy as we are today. It takes time for wealth to accumulate, but it's got to start. And the fact that they are not immediately as wealthy as we are, and that they are not paid immediately what we're paid, and that their work conditions are not immediately as good as ours, that doesn't mean that we should not trade with them. That doesn't mean anything is wrong. It just means that they are in their stage of economic development in the same way that we too were at an earlier stage of economic development. And it's the height of both, of either ignorance or haughtiness or both, for a rich Westerner in America or Western Europe to say, oh, we can't trade with those foreigners because they get paid so much less than we do that it's unfair for us to trade. I firmly believe, and I know from the facts, that Americans benefit from freer trade. But even if Americans didn't benefit from freer trade, then I'm still in favor of it, because I don't think government has any business telling people how they should spend their money. And secondly, the fact that foreigners benefit, poor foreigners benefit usually from free trade, is to me a great argument for it. Why should we condemn poor people in China, poor people in India, poor people in Malaysia and elsewhere to continued misery and poverty just to protect our high wages? And again, fortunately, our high wages are not threatened by it. But even if they were, it's a very difficult moral case to say that, well, we can't let our standard of living be threatened because these poor people are trying to move out of poverty.
You brought up another really interesting bugaboo in terms of free trade, and that's China. Specifically, media always brings out often touted reports, you know, record trade deficit with China, or the United States is sending too many dollars overseas. Or I know you talked about this earlier in the show about when they sell stuff to the United States, they have dollars so they can reinvest it. But is there really such thing as a trade deficit?
Well, you can define something and call it a trade deficit, and there is such a thing. What a trade deficit is, according to the way it's defined, is when we, in the domestic economy, in America in this case, when we import more in dollar terms during a year than we export. All right, that's a trade deficit. But when you have to ask, well, what are foreigners doing with the money that they don't spend buying American exports? The answer is they're investing it in America. And that means, and we have a term for it, that's called a capital account surplus. The U.S. trade deficit, or more specifically, the current account deficit, is exactly offset, exactly to the penny, by something called a capital account surplus. Capital account surplus means that foreigners are investing here more than we're investing abroad. That's a good thing. Why should we not want foreigners to invest here? Number one, it signals that foreigners still think, at least relative to other countries, that America is a desirable place to invest, and the investments themselves help to make that true. When capital comes to America, factories get built, we get more R&D, we get more worker training, we get more IKEA stores built. We get lower interest rates because foreigners help to fund Uncle Sam's prodigious borrowing habits. So all that the trade deficit, when I hear trade deficit, I think, oh, that's great, that's good. I mean, foreigners, rather than cashing out their dollars immediately to buy stuff from us, are instead saying, you know, I want to spend some of those dollars on investments in America. I want to invest some of those dollars in the U.S. economy. I think that to be a good thing. The trade deficit gets a lot of bad press because people do not understand what it is. They hear the word deficit and they think, oh, that must be bad. But again, and this is just a matter of fact, another name for the trade deficit is capital account surplus. surplus sounds good, but it doesn't sound as good in the news because you can't wring your hands over it and pretend that some catastrophe is looming if you use the word surplus.
Well, and when there was a trade deficit, there was actually when has there been extended periods of time when the United States had a quote unquote trade deficit or trade surplus rather?
Well, my favorite example, I went back and a few years ago and looked at the 1930s, which of course was the most dismal decade economically in America by a long shot. And during that entire decade, for the whole decade, America ran a very large trade surplus. In fact, of the 120 months during that decade, only 8 of those months did America run a trade deficit. And it was a tiny, in each of those 8 months, it was very tiny. So for 112 of the 120 months during the 1930s, the Great Depression, America ran a trade surplus. And the reason is obvious. No one wants to invest in an economy that's in a deep slump. And the American economy in the 1930s was, of course, in a deep slump. So foreigners, they don't want to invest here. In fact, Americans were seeking to invest elsewhere, which is why we had a trade surplus. And so if trade surpluses are so good for the economy, then the 1930s should have been a boom period. Not so. If trade deficits are bad for the economy, then, oh, I don't know, the 1990s should have been a depressed period. It wasn't so. No topic in international trade is more misunderstood than the trade deficit. People get it wrong, and they get it exactly wrong. It's really discouraging.
Yeah, we're coming up to our final break here on Radio Free Market. Please stay tuned after the break. We'll talk more with Dr. Donald Boudreau about globalization. Welcome back to Radio Free Market. I'm your guest host, Drew Yelm. On the phone with me is Donald Boudreau, and we're talking about globalization. And before the break, we were talking about trade deficits, and it seemed that there's a lot of misconceptions about that. And another topic we also wanted to talk about was foreign aid. Now, does foreign aid help other countries?
No, it does not. Foreign aid, what people mean by foreign aid is what the great late economist Peter Bauer, who was one of the great experts on foreign trade, he refused to call it foreign aid. He called it government-to-government transfers. Foreign aid is just a gift from rich governments to poor governments. For a variety of reasons. Foreign aid in that way, of course, then hurts the ordinary citizens of the countries whose governments receive the aid because it subsidizes those governments' bad policies. If you're a government abroad, then you know that you can get more money from America and from Western Europe because Americans and Western Europeans think your economy is in a shambles, what incentive do you have to get your economy out of the shambles? What incentive do you have to adopt policies or to push for policies that will improve the economy? None. In fact, you have incentives to keep the economy in a shambles because the very shambleness of the economy is your ticket to getting money from Uncle Sam and from Western European governments. And that money goes directly to you. And, of course, then you have the big slush fund with which to pay off, you know, your friends and treat yourself. Foreign aid is a catastrophe. The world's leading expert on it, I think the world's leading expert on it now, is an NYU economist named Bill Easterly, and he's done wonderful work. And he used to be a believer in foreign aid, and he went back and just looked at the history of foreign aid. And he said, you know, you just look at it from the 1950s on, and it does, there are different rationales for it. None of them have panned out. No evidence that foreign aid has helped countries to develop. We should distinguish between aid for emergency purposes. I mean, if a country has a natural disaster, then getting in quickly food aid and first and medical aid, that can be beneficial. But that's not the same thing as giving money to countries for the purpose of making them develop. And look, the United States didn't have foreign aid to develop. It's another one of the great myths that, well, countries are mired in poverty. Once you're mired in poverty, you somehow can't get out of poverty. That's nonsense. The United States was once mired in poverty, and we got out of poverty without foreign aid. Taiwan, by the way, got very little foreign aid because of the complicated political relationship with Red China. And Taiwan, you know, developed quite well, having gotten only a tiny, tiny fraction of foreign aid, I think gotten none since 1964, and it continues to develop. Africa, on the other hand, sub-Saharan Africa in particular, has gotten huge amounts of foreign aid. And while things are starting to look up in the last couple of years in South Africa compared to what they were, it's been a catastrophe there. And one reason they're looking up, by the way, is because the amount of, you know, the amount of foreign aid pouring into sub-Saharan Africa has started to subside a little bit, or Africans are adopting more market-friendly policies. So foreign aid does not work in any way that it's trumpeted by its apologists is working.
That really kind of seems like it sums up government economic policy in a nutshell.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it is. It's just another variant of the same problem. Look, our economic problems are not caused by too little money. Our economic problems, to the extent that they exist, are caused by too little enterprise and too little freedom of consumers to spend their money as they wish, and hence too little incentive for entrepreneurs to produce products that consumers want to buy, as opposed to producing products that are politically popular, or worse, spending those entrepreneurs and businesses spending their resources courting government privileges rather than courting consumers' patronage in a competitive market.
I would like to thank Dr. Boudreau for being on the show with us today.
It's been my pleasure.
For Radio Free Market, I'm Drew Yelm. Please visit us on the web at radiofreemarket.com, where you can subscribe for free to all of our podcasts. Also, too, check out our guest website, cafehayek.com, brilliant blog with very interesting commentary about free trade and many other topics. Wherever you are, please stand up for freedom.